From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The Sunday news shows yesterday were packed. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney trying to walk back his Ukraine quid pro quo statement. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arguing that hypotheticals are not reality and reality is not hypotheticals. Four-star General Raymond Thomas on the future of Syria. In other words, Sunday news shows are still the place where powerful politicians deign to take the tough questions. Margaret Brennan is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. She's currently the only woman leading a Sunday network news show. So what does she make of American politics right now and journalism's role in it? This hour on Point, CBS's Margaret Brennan. And you can join us. Are you a Sunday news show viewer? What's your take on Face the Nation and what is your question for Margaret Brennan? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Margaret Brennan joins us in the studio today. As I mentioned, of course, she is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. She's also a CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent. She's covered basically everything: business, markets, international relations, politics, the White House, presidential administrations. And she joins us today in the On Point studio. It's great to have you, Margaret.
It's so great to be here with you.
All right. So first of all, I just want to talk to you about yesterday's show, since the news doesn't stop. I want to play a moment from your interview with retired four-star general Raymond Thomas, former commanding general of U.S. Special Operations Command. And he, when he was talking to you on Face the Nation, he contradicted the State Department's stance that the U.S. had never promised protection for the Kurds. And here's what he told you.
But they believe that they would be part of the fabric of the future of Syria. And obviously, right now, they are forced to make deals with the Syrian regime and the Russians.
Well, that's an important point you raised there, because the State Department has said that no promise was ever made to the Kurds to help protect them. But you're saying there was some understanding.
There was absolutely a discussion. Brett McGurk and I were there in Kobani, where we said that they would be part of the future discussion of Syria in return for doing our bidding.
So that's retired four-star general Raymond Thomas speaking to Margaret Brennan yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation. I mean, Margaret, you've covered foreign affairs and now as the host of this major Sunday news show. I mean, what do you make of sort of where we are regarding Syria and what the general told you there?
Well, what was so extraordinary about hearing from the general, from Tony Thomas, was he was the man who built out, along with Brett McGurk, who he referenced there, who was the president's special envoy for ISIS from the Obama and the Trump administration. They built the architecture to fight ISIS. They went in and brokered these understandings, as he said in that clip, so the Kurds would do our bidding, mm-hmm. so that they would fight for us in this joint cause of defeating ISIS militarily. And it's just, I think we're at this really interesting moment, because Syria has always been complicated. It has always been this tenuous agreement that was brokered for the United States to be sort of half in, half out, involved by only by fighting ISIS, not countering the Assad regime. I mean, we were always sort of half pregnant in the conflict from the Obama through the Trump administration. But in this moment, having someone who is that tip of that spear say that this is basically leaving our allies to find a way to survive was really harsh and a reality check. He also predicted that ISIS will resurge.
Right. Well, in the same show, you talked to former Ambassador William Burns as well just yesterday, and you asked him about Vice President Pence's latest trip to Turkey and whether – and this is a really interesting notion to explore – whether U.S. actions in the region could be viewed as surrender.
You know, typically it's a rule that military presence gives diplomatic leverage when you're in a negotiation. When Vice President Pence went to Turkey this week, he promised to lift U.S. sanctions. He seemed to promise that the U.S. allies would withdraw from this area as well. Was this a negotiation, or was this, as some say, a surrender?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a smart way and a dumb way to deal with what was a very complicated situation in which we had modest leverage in northeast Syria. I think we chose the dumb way. In one impulsive presidential phone call, we, in a sense, gave away our leverage. And then in a pretty hasty negotiated ceasefire, we threw the Kurds under the bus.
Margaret, Burns' response is really interesting. We can talk about that. But it's your question more than anything that I wanted to ask you about, because I do something sort of similar to you, not on the same sort of platform here, but why did you choose to ask that question in that way? And using that word surrender?
Well, because it had been criticized, and the vice president's negotiation had been criticized and described as such. If you look at the actual terms of what was agreed to, it was billed a ceasefire. It was a five-day pause. But this was our Kurdish allies giving up the area that they consider part of their homeland, mm-hmm. Being asked to retreat. And in exchange, the U.S. also pulling back sanctions. It didn't sound like the U.S. was getting much of what it actually was seeking in terms of having a goal to achieve something in Syria. It's retrofitting a policy to the withdrawal that was already decided upon, which is the reason I asked it of Burns, of course, is because there are very few American diplomats who have even achieved his status. He is one of the most senior diplomats in American history as a career foreign policy person. He's negotiated with Erdogan. He's negotiated with Putin. And I knew he would have an interesting take on what it's like to try to walk into a room when you don't have the military leverage in your back pocket, and you're looking for what point to push Erdogan on, the Turkish president. That's why I asked him about the removal of troops first and then the promise that was made on the back end, because it looked like the U.S. did give some real concessions here.
Right. Do you think the Trump administration was prepared at all for the kind of pushback it has received over the past couple of weeks on the Syria decision?
No. I think it has really surprised so many people, including fellow Republicans, that the president has been somewhat immovable in this decision. And it's actually extraordinary because the president's allies are correct in saying he's been promising this. He has been saying this. But so often in Washington, we hear, particularly from national security officials, look at what we do. Don't listen to what's said. And that's a wink and a nod, like, don't pay attention to the tweets. It's what the national security officials often say to people in our line of work. And yet in this case, you needed to listen to what the president said, because it was actually where his end goal was. The entire strategy was simply pull out. The rest of what the national security establishment was arguing was, if we need to get there, let's do it in, you know, a systematic way. Mm-hmm. And so it has certainly surprised many that Mitch McConnell, leader in the Senate, is standing up to the president on this and saying this is a grave mistake.
Yeah, and Lindsey Graham very vociferously until perhaps just this weekend, where he dared to voice a little bit of optimism. But on this note that you're making about watch what they do, not necessarily what they say, on October 13th, you interviewed the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper. And during that interview, he talked about that President Trump, or announced that President Trump, had ordered all troops out of northern Syria, or was in the process of doing so. And then you pressed him on details. And let's listen to that exchange.
European allies are looking at this, and when they hear the president say things like these ISIS fighters will just flee to Europe, they say that is not appreciating the alliance, that Turkey has been far too permissive in allowing ISIS fighters within its territory. They see this as inevitable, that we are headed towards a terrorist attack because of this chaos that the U.S. is allowing in the vacuum.
Well, let's be clear. The United States is not allowing this. Turkey committed this action. They decided to make an incursion in northern Syria, despite our protestations, our urgings not to do it, all of our warnings. They decided to do it. The situation
with
the U.S.
ISIS is being permissive, arguably, by pulling back and not stopping them.
We are doing what's in the interests of our service members, not to put them in harm's way.
Tell me more about that interview. I mean, what was Esper's sort of approach and response like to your questions?
Well, you know, it was an extraordinary morning. I came in to do the show. We knew we were going to have the Secretary of Defense for his very first Sunday show interview, and we were excited about that and wanted to talk to him about Syria. And around 7-something in the morning, 7:15 in the morning, I knew we were going to be pre-taping with him before our 10:30 a.m. show. And I get a text saying, from a source, we're preparing to evacuate Syria. Mm-hmm. And my mind went immediately to, oh my gosh, this changes the entire trajectory here, and trying to get details. And I went in to talk to Esper, and he said, yeah, let's sit down, let's do this. And he went into the details on air, but they were limited details because the policy was still being figured out. It had just been decided the night before. And as you see, even today, there are tweaks and changes being made here. It's interesting to hear in that clip again that defense secretaries say we don't want to leave troops in harm's way. And then today you learn that the Trump administration hasn't made the final decision, but is looking to leave a few hundred troops mm-hmm. in southern Syria. That doesn't take them out of harm's way. That's a small footprint. And that's always the argument for having a bigger one to keep enemies at bay.
So the notion that policy is literally being made as – or decisions, national security decisions are being made as you're interviewing the very people who are involved in those decisions sort of in real time. How do you – I mean, how do you handle – how do you manage those moments?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, before I went to Washington, I don't think I appreciated that. And, you know, there were obviously – there are always audibles called by national security officials, and they have to respond to things that are changing on the ground and in the moment. But the degree to which it's happening now is really extraordinary and completely different. You know, through the Obama administration, I remember the Syria policy, the red line moment, all that. That was all retrofitted policy to a comment that was made. This is actually movement of U.S. troops and very, very consequential decisions that are still being figured out in terms of pulling the troops out of Syria now. They're not going home. They're going to Western Iraq. Where were they going that day? I asked Esper, and he was still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. So they knew they were pulling out, but they didn't know where they were putting the troops that they were pulling back. And so he was still trying to work this out himself. Wow. To implement the president's policy, because the policy was simply withdrawal. Wow. Nothing more.
Well, we are talking this hour with Margaret Brennan. She is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. She's also CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent. She's reported on just about anything, everything, politics, international affairs, global markets, presidential administrations. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk with her more about her view of journalism in this moment in America in 2019. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Margaret Brennan. She is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and a CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent. And we're talking to her about what it's like facing down the most powerful political leaders in the world and definitely in this country, and journalism's role right now in 2019. Margaret, if I may, this weekend was just, I was going to say it was so tumultuous, but every weekend kind of feels like that, to be perfectly honest. But I wanted to play a couple more moments from some of your writing. Rival Sunday shows, just because of the folks that they featured, and I wanted to get your quick take on it. Because first of all, yesterday on Fox News Sunday, with Chris Wallace, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney tried to walk back those comments that he had made last week when he linked U.S. Military aid, money for military aid, to Ukraine, with that investigation that the president wanted Ukraine to enact on Joe Biden, essentially that quid pro quo. And here's how Chris Wallace engaged with Mick Mulvaney on that issue.
You were asked specifically by Jonathan Carl, was investigating Democrats one of the conditions for holding up the aid? Was that part of the quid pro quo? And you said it happens all the time.
Yeah, but go back and watch what I said before. That I don't know if you guys can cue it up or not. There was a long answer about corruption and
you totally said that.
Just like I told you then, and then I said the exact same thing I just said now.
I just have to pause there because I've heard this clip over and over again. And Margaret, I mean, it seems on the face of it that Mick Mulvaney is just quite frankly just denying what he said last week. Is that what it sounds like to you?
Oh, he is. I mean, he's saying, because he never, and this was a great interview. Chris Wallace did a great job. Mick, I think, says at some point, I never used the words quid pro quo, therefore I wasn't confirming it. He was trying to clean up what happened at that press conference, but he was pressed on every point he should have been by Chris Wallace, who didn't let him wiggle away on that point. And the point is important because it's not just a flub or a misstep, but there is an impeachment inquiry underway on Capitol Hill right now, and those depositions are all behind closed doors. This was on national, international, live television as it happened. So the world got to see this part of the story when they haven't heard all the details that are still being gathered as the investigation is underway with all these other players. So it had a big impact on the investigation and on public perception of it, and it will continue to be a problem for the acting chief of staff.
Yeah. Well, also a problem for the Secretary of State as well, because Mike Pompeo, he was on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, and the Secretary of State, quite frankly, he hedged some of his answers when Stephanopoulos questioned him about that withholding of aid to Ukraine. So let's listen to that.
Do you agree then with Senator McKesson that it would have been inappropriate to withhold the military aid unless this political investigation was pursued?
George, I'm telling you what I was involved with. I'm telling you what I saw transpiring and how President Trump was working to make the evaluation about whether it was appropriate to provide this assistance.
But that's what I'm asking is, would it be appropriate to condition that?
Yeah, George, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals and secondary things based on what someone else has said. George, you would have never done it when you were the spokesman. I'm not going to do it here today.
Except it's not a hypothetical. We saw the chief of staff, the acting chief of staff.
It is, George.
Right,
you just
there.
Said if it, you, George, you just said if this happened, that is by definition a hypothetical.
The chief of staff said it did.
George, you asked me if this happened. It's a hypothetical. I've told you what I observed, what I saw the process related to this very funding.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talking with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week. Now, Margaret, we can sort of dissect exactly what happened in that exchange here, but I wanted to play it for you because I feel like it's emblematic of the challenge that any journalist has in this day and age interviewing members of this particular administration, right? I mean, there's a point at which do you have to make a decision in your mind? Like, am I going to pin down this powerful political leader on their evasiveness about this one fact? Mm-hmm. Or am I going to try and get them to actually tell us more about the administration's next step? I mean, it feels like it's a very precarious decision-making process every time you sit down to interview someone, is it?
It is. It's very challenging, and it's all or mostly live television. So you're making those calls as you go, where you're trying to listen, and as you know, trying to listen to a producer as well. It's a real challenge, and we're at this moment where things are of real consequence in terms of this impeachment inquiry as well. So every word that is said is parsed, and we had two of the investigators on my program on Sunday talking about exactly that. One of the things that is challenging as well is what you laid out, that choice of do you go with my instinct as a reporter and correspondent, which is to pull out more information, try to understand, try to ask the follow-up to move the story forward, or are you in the pinning down, which can sometimes be chasing down rabbit holes, and sometimes it doesn't take you anywhere, and sometimes that just plays into what is often used as a device to deflect, which is to say you're arguing with me or that's an opinion. So it's always tough to make that call.
You know, it is absolutely. I mean, as I watch these shows and occasionally when I do some interviews like this, it is a tough decision making process. But are we, I guess what I'm saying is, are we at a point? You do this day in and day out. Are we at a point where the deflection is the news?
It's part of it, certainly. Yeah. And that's one of the things that is so tremendously important about Sunday shows still, and I'm talking my own book, but particularly for Face, is after the fact, when you go back and you read the transcript and you look at it, you are often starting your own news cycle for the week that's about to come, particularly in this impeachment cycle. And this is one of the few places where you can have an extended conversation, not just a, you know, what is it, 140-character tweet now, and not just a quick soundbite. It's dangerous territory for some of the cabinet officials to step into. But the Trump administration, sometimes to their credit, is choosing to engage still. The president does watch television. He watches all the Sunday shows, and he wants his story continuing to be told. So it's a bit of a minefield sometimes if there is a misstep. Mick Mulvaney had a very high profile one from the podium this past week. I think he would even acknowledge that and did on air.
I think it's 280 characters on Twitter.
Is it 280 now? I don't even know.
Yeah. Or the endless Twitter thread, which like doesn't matter how many characters you want to put out there. Well, Margaret, stand by for just a second. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Leicester, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. About 3 or 4 years ago on a Sunday morning, I came downstairs and my son was laying on the couch watching television, and he was watching Face the Nation instead of SportsCenter, which really caught me by surprise. So I would like to thank his high school teacher, Rigo, but specifically Margaret and John Dickerson and all of your peers for making it a little bit more fun and pointed to be able to watch television. He is now a junior at University of Rhode Island. He's a journalism major, and he makes sure that he watches the news every day.
You must be very proud of him.
I am, and I want to thank you because, I listen to NPR on the radio and I listen to podcasts and all that stuff, but for him to pass up Red Sox highlights on a Sunday morning, I tribute you guys to be able to keep his interest. So
well,
thank you very much.
Well, look, it can be a contact sport, journalism these days, unfortunately.
Well, and Paul's son choosing you over the Red Sox, that seems to be a really big deal, Paul. But thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Barbara, who's calling from Vestal, New York. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm happy to hear Margaret's station. I've been watching her since she's moved on into that position. One of the things I've noted, you know, some of the more powerful political figures, such as Secretary Pompeo, they have an attitude when on air, and I'm wondering if that attitude sometimes it seems arrogant, but is there a way that perhaps being a female journalist and facing these high-profile, powerful men, do you have any sense that your being a female influences how they respond and react? And I'll listen on air. Thank you.
That is a really, really, really great question, and it's something that I spend a lot of time, particularly of late, thinking about. Gender always does play a role in some ways in terms of how people perceive you, how they hear you, how comments land, how viewers are receiving, really pushing, as you say, having to pin down and be dogged. It's not always received well if it's a female interviewer versus a male interviewer. I think figuring out how to do the best job you can, because frankly, no matter what gender you are in television news, you're all measured by the same thing, which is the news you make or break and the ratings you are able to deliver. But how the audience hears you or how the interviewer does is also interesting. You know, are they more comfortable talking over you because it's a female voice? Are they more comfortable, perhaps having a conversation with you because you don't come off in the same overly aggressive, argumentative way that some have the ability to adapt. It's really an interesting thing. I think it depends on the person. I'd love to say it's both an asset and something that you have to figure out how to manage around, just like anything with being a woman. I think there is always another side story to it. And it's something that we could have a bottle of wine and spend a lot of time parsing each interview over. Well, but we've got a tremendous number of female staff members, too. And we talk about this.
So let me ask you, though, when you have interviewed the president, for example, who, during the campaign, I think made pretty obviously misogynistic statements. Did you get any sense that you being a powerful female journalist was that he was approaching you differently?
No, okay. I didn't at all.
Okay.
And I didn't approach it any differently. I think we ended up having about 45 minutes with the president. He went longer than we expected and was generous with his time in that way because I think we were able to engage. And I was pulling information out of him about some of the things that he would have to make decisions on the national security front, something that he doesn't often engage on, and can probably recite a lot of the things he talks about on a regular basis. And so we tried to cover some other territory, like the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and what he was thinking on Iran and what he was thinking on immigration.
Well, in fact, I think we have a little bit of tape from your February interview with the president. You did push him on why his opinions about certain things may not change when the facts on the ground do change. I mean, for example, he said that ISIS was almost entirely eradicated, and you questioned him on that. And here he is in that portion of your interview with him, and he begins by saying that one of his most important campaign promises was to bring troops home.
Now, if you go back and look at any of my campaign speeches or rallies, I talked about it all the time.
You did. You've been talking about this.
I want to bring people home.
But that's one of the questions here, is because you have these strongly held convictions, and people ask, Well, why don't the facts influence those opinions if those facts change? And your director of national intelligence said ISIS still has strongholds in Iraq and Syria and will launch attacks from there.
You're going to always have pockets of something.
Tell me more about that interview.
Well, it was interesting. This was to air during the Super Bowl. CBS had the broadcast of it. And so we had this tradition of being able to sit down with the president. And as I said, he gave us about 45 minutes. What had just set the table for that is we were coming off the back end of that 35-day shutdown that didn't pay off well politically for the president because he did not get the immigration concessions that he wanted. If you remember the showdown with Nancy Pelosi, it was like a million crises ago. And it was on the back of some intelligence hearings with the director of national intelligence and others who laid out the threat assessment, which they do and publish every year. And a number of points in it directly contradicted the president's own personal beliefs. That didn't land well with him, whether it was on Iran or whether it was on North Korea or whether it was specifically on ISIS. And we're still talking about it now. You know, Tony Thomas, the general, the former head of special operations, said on Sunday on our program, he believes ISIS will resurge.
Right.
And Mike Morrell, former CIA director who was on with us, a colleague of mine at CBS, was saying that loss of intelligence that is gathered on the ground from having a U.S. presence there will contribute to it. So that is one of the things that I was trying to pull out of the president was he is very focused and true to his brand. And that brand of policy, ending endless wars, bringing troops home, which, by the way, lands well. It lands well for Elizabeth Warren, too, on the campaign trail. But for any president, it's always more complicated than that when you get to the position. So President Obama struggled with it. Everyone does. Why not adapt things more?
Can I just ask you, I mean, obviously, I've never had the opportunity to interview the president. I mean, what is it like interviewing him? Is he... Because we, you know, we see the final TV product when it's not a live interview. I mean, is he a different kind of interview, or does he present you a different set of challenges than any other person you've interviewed before?
Yes, and I had been a White House correspondent, so I'd interacted with him. But that's in these chaotic sprays you see of shouting questions, where he can kind of control which one he hears and which one he doesn't want to answer, or at press conferences, having an extended give and take. Is a different thing. And preparing for that, you know, compared notes with our executive producer, Mary Hagar, senior producer, Kat Reynolds. I mean, we all combined thoughts and wrote out questions, but it's really kind of in the moment making the, calling those audibles of, do I jump in here? Do I interject? Do I correct? Do I follow him there? But how do I get back to the point that I was asking rather than the place he's taking me, which may be a different side story. And it was challenging because I also didn't know who I was walking into the room to see that day.
Right.
Because this had been on the back of this, you know, political loss, essentially, on the back of the government shutdown at that time where he didn't get the immigration concessions. Was he going to be upset? Was he going to be, you know, wanting to put a good face on things? I think he, in that moment, realized also that this was a tremendous platform with a extremely high number of viewers. I mean, the Super Bowl and that viewership is tremendous for him. And he is a TV person. And he knew that. He knew who he was reaching. And he knew he was talking and engaging in a different way than when he does hits with perhaps Fox News, where it's a very different conversation. So I was wondering who's going to sit down across from me. And my colleague Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes, I talked to her at length about that. And she said that is really going to influence the rest of the interview. How does he walk into the room and how does he feel?
Well, how did he walk into the room?
Very composed.
Okay.
And that's why I say I think from the moment it began, it was, this is a presidential interview and we are going to have a substantive conversation and it'll be a give and take. But it wasn't, you know, the same as when you see him in other venues like his rally.
Right.
It's a very different beast.
Or his sort of free-flowing conversations that he has occasionally with reporters in front of Marine One now these days.
Exactly.
Well, we are talking this hour with Margaret Brennan. She is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. We'll take more of your questions when we come right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university. shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Margaret Brennan. She is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent as well. Margaret, on our website, AB Daigle is saying, I religiously record and watch almost every Sunday morning news show from 7 a.m. to noon. I watch them all. AB Daigle's a real lover of the show, including Meet the Press, Face the Nation, Fox News Sunday, This Week with Stephanopoulos. Margaret is good and tough. I would like to see more experts included and politicians asked to respond. And then AB says, plus fewer ads that break up the good conversations.
Can we have to pay the bills.
Well, fortunately, we don't have that problem here on public radio, AB Daigle, but I'm glad you're tuning in now. Let's go to Jane, who's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Jane, you're on the air.
Hi. You were speaking earlier about how spontaneous and almost off the cuff some of Trump's decisions seem and some of the events taking place. And I just wonder if maybe some of it has less to do with Trump are the things most people don't like about him, and more to do with the fact that he's a little bit more modern president in a modern era. I mean, with Facebook and Twitter and social media, things happen more immediately now. Mm-hmm. We're more aware of them. Things, we get information more quickly. And so things seem to be going at a lot more fast pace. And I just wondered what you thought of that.
You're certainly right. Things are going at a faster pace. And I understand what you're saying. And I certainly know that the president's allies would argue that that is an attribute and that he doesn't like inefficiency and he's just moving faster because he's, more able and flexible to do that than others. The challenge is that this isn't about the person. This is about the office and that tremendous tanker you are trying to drive, that is the entire U.S. government. And process, as unsexy and as boring as it sounds, is absolutely required when it's of these particularly life and death decisions. So, like Syria. And that is, in some ways, the difference between why there are no policy rollouts on things like healthcare and this and that. It's on the life and death battlefield issues, the Pentagon is always planning. They need to be able to plan out for scenarios, as do other agencies that support it. And so spontaneous decisions like revert to what I said, just get everyone out, does lead to a scramble. And that is illustrated by, in terms of what a scramble it was, the fact that the U.S. military bombed some of their own positions last week because the advancing armies were moving faster than the U.S. could retreat. And so that is why being spontaneous in situations like that is perilous for people who are in these positions on the ground.
Well, so if I can just piggyback on, Jane's observation about the social media age that we're living in here. I mean, that's something that I constantly think about, that people do have, I wouldn't call it news, but information or statements at the tips of their fingertips.
Absolutely.
So what role do we play? I mean, in this current media environment.
As journalists, you mean?
Well, I'm going to ask you specifically on that Sunday show on Face the Nation. What role this is a venerable institution that's been around since 1954. Mm-hmm. What role does Face the Nation play now in this day and age?
Well, I feel like it is a whole news ecosystem that we all kind of need to play off of each other in that the story is always moving and you're sort of picking up the baton from one to move the story forward in the next news article or the next TV interview. And that cycle of 24-hour news and certainly social media speeds that up incredibly. With the Sunday shows, it is different. There are only still three major networks that have this program, and we are – I so respect the fact that we've been on air for 65 years doing this, that it is still a place to have an extended conversation. And the way I view our position is that it is not a place where you're tuning in for an argument and a food fight between two talking heads who one checks the box of having an R next to his name and one has a D next to her name. That's not what I am doing, because that is not providing, in my view, the service that is needed, which is sort of like, okay, time out. What happened this week that's of consequence? And what do you need to know when you start your week that next Monday morning after you watch the Sunday shows? So that's how I view our particular time slot in our platform.
I would also say that from viewers' perspective, the Sunday shows are still the place where decision makers reliably go.
Yes.
To you know, be questioned. And in fact, the places that they're willing to go gets diminished with every passing year. So it's sort of one of those playing fields that's becoming increasingly rare in American journalism. And I'm thankful that they're there, because then, you know, the folks say something on Sunday and it sort of flows through the news ecosystem, exactly, as you were saying before. But just for fun, I mean, since we're talking about what a venerable institution this idea of the Sunday news show is, we dug up some sound from the first ever Face the Nation, which aired on November 7th, 1950.
How cool.
And the first guest was Senator Joseph McCarthy talking about the impending censure vote that was going to happen. less than a month later, the Senate did vote indeed to censure Senator McCarthy. And you're going to hear him speaking first with William Lawrence of the New York Times. You'll hear Senator McCarthy speaking first, and then William Lawrence of the New York Times will break in and ask a question.
I was talking to one of my Democrat friends the other day. He told me very frankly he was going to vote for censure. He said, not because of the silly reasons given by the Watkins Committee. He said, but because you labeled the Democrat Party as the party of communism.
You issued an open invitation during the Army-McCarthy hearings for people to continue to supply you with information.
That's right.
Regardless of its stamping. Are you getting new information from people in this administration basis?
Let me change your question a bit. I invited them to give information of wrongdoing, graft, corruption, communism. I am continuing to get that information.
Senator Joseph McCarthy on November 7th, 1954, the first ever broadcast of Face the Nation. And Senator McCarthy there showing quite a skillful pivot, I have to say, at the end of that clip here. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Oriental, North Carolina. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. The Sunday shows are an institution, and I think they're a tremendous responsibility in terms of helping our society know what's true and not. Question, in the name of journalistic integrity, does Margaret's production team ever come to the realization that a person, no matter, even if they are very highly placed in our government, they are simply not leveling. They have a track record of not leveling with the American public on this forum, and we're just not going to have them anymore. You don't have to name names, but have you reached that point in this era when you recognize that there are folks that are just not going to level in that forum? Thank you very much.
Jim, thank you for your call. And Margaret, if you do want to name names, I'm anxious to hear them.
No, this is it's an important point. And we know how we have great respect for our platform. We want to make sure that the guests do as well. And we talk a great deal. We've got a great booking team. And we put a lot of thought into who's going to be the most knowledgeable about the issue, but perhaps also the most engaging and most thoughtful as well. Are they a player in the story, or are they just an observer to it? We put in a lot of thought to that. And yes, look, talking points are how people survive. But if you just allow people to stay on their talking points, you're not actually able to learn much. And so you're always pushing people to try to level, as you said.
Well, just broadly speaking, what do you think is one of the toughest interviews that you've done so far on Face the Nation?
Oh, on Face the Nation. Well, there are like so many different reasons why certain things were tough. I think in this moment where we are, there are things that are emotional and people get really heated on. Immigration's one of them, mm-hmm. where you just get anger from a lot of people on both sides. On this moment with the impeachment inquiry, I think it is of such great consequence, but it is also hard to pull out new information on it that can be really tough. In terms of what is the most exasperating, it's when you can't pull someone off that talking point mm-hmm. or when they're shouting over you, not respectful of the platform, not respectful of the interviewer. That is very frustrating. That happens.
Well, actually, so can I just play a moment? I don't know if you think this interview qualifies, but your September 29th interview with Rudy Giuliani?
Oh.
Okay, well, let's... Okay. You're a busy person.
Rudy's Rudy.
Rudy's Rudy. But I just want to play it anyway because I think it's pretty demonstrative here. So Margaret Brennan did speak with Rudy Giuliani on September 29th. You talked to him about his involvement in Ukraine. And here's that interaction.
Who is that? I did not do this on my own. I did it at the request of the State Department. And I have all of the text messages to prove it. And I also have a thank you from them for doing a good job.
Who sent you that?
I don't know why the State Department
is running away
from it.
Did Secretary of State Pompeo know you were doing these things? Did he ask you to do these things?
He did not. Mr. Volker did, and then Mr. Sondland did. But when I talked to the secretary last week, he said he was aware of it. He told me that he was aware of it.
So you're saying the Secretary of State didn't instruct you to set up these meetings, but he knew what you were doing when you were meeting with members of the Ukrainian government?
No,
I'm asking you to clarify that. What exactly did Pompeo know?
I think I clarified it, but I'm happy to say it again.
Please do.
It's Margaret Brennan interviewing Rudy Giuliani on September 29th. Let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say how excited I am that you're interviewing Margaret Brennan. I was just telling my partner and friend yesterday about how much I appreciate and admire her. Steady and incisive manner. She doesn't miss a beat. She clearly values scholarship, which is sadly lacking in many of the other TV news stations. And I love how she adapts to unexpected answers from her interviewees with professionalism and integrity. It underscores the depth of her preparation. She's just such a skillful navigator of discourse. And I think myself being a teacher and a science writer, I find that she's a beacon and an example for aspiring young female journalists. And I wanted to just ask, what was her path to her current position and what did she study? How does she prepare for Face the Nation?
Thank you so much. Those are just such lovely things to hear. And are you sure your last name's not Brennan? I appreciate all of what you're saying. My background, I went to University of Virginia. I studied foreign affairs and Middle East studies, and I minored in Arabic. So I obviously was always interested in national security. I went to Wall Street for 10 years. I covered CNBC and Bloomberg there. I did financial news. And I grew up in Connecticut with a dad on Wall Street. My mom's an artist and a teacher, and was always a little bit of a bookish nerd, and appreciated the wonderful teachers that I had, the people in your line of work at my schools in Greenwich, Connecticut, Common of the Sacred Heart and St. Peter's in Danbury, Connecticut.
And she also, Catherine also was wondering, how do you prepare for your interviews?
It's a lot like cramming for an exam in college, or that's how I approach it. I try to understand as much as I can about whatever the political moment is, because you're trying to see where you can move it forward. You also, as a team, sit down and talk. We've got a great team of producers where we try to read up on that individual who's coming on and say, okay, where can we make news with this person, or what is their background on this or that? And you strategize a little bit. But some of it is it's in the moment and it's live. So some of it's just sort of the instinct on what you go on. But there's a whole lot of preparation that the Face the Nation team does every week to help me.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, Margaret, can we talk a little bit about work-life balance? Because
is there balance?
Actually, that's true. The phrase itself is problematic.
Right.
But you're still a relatively new mom.
I am.
Right? So how's that going? Given the demands and the profile of the job that you have.
My son is 13 months old, and he's absolutely incredible. His name's Eamon. My husband and I are totally in love with him, as all parents are. And he's 100% the best part of the day. We're very fortunate. He absolutely changed my life. Because I started as moderator of Face the Nation while I was pregnant and, you know, had to go on maternity leave, a short one. My colleague John Dickerson filled in. It's been learning to adapt from the moment. You know, I was new to the show and felt like it was my baby when I had my own at the same time. And, you know, we have a great supportive group of producers and everyone who worked along with me to figure out how do I do all these things. But I think it's something that every single mom in this country who, particularly those who aren't as fortunate to have the great help that I have and the ability to take paid leave and to do all that, struggle with. It's in this incredibly unique role. You know, I joked, I don't think the other Sunday show hosts had to worry about, you know, keeping a breast pump on their desk. That's mm-hmm. just the sad reality. It may make a lot of people uncomfortable that I even said that out loud. But it's the realness of trying to talk about how hard it is that I think is helpful, I find, to other women. It was helpful to me to understand that coming back from maternity leave, that you're not just snap your fingers the same person you were. You're adapting. And I think it's opened up to me a number of things that are interesting to talk about and like paid leave and the support network you need and all of that. But it's a gift.
It is a gift. And Margaret, it's been so terrific to have you here this hour. I'm afraid we have to wrap up with that. Margaret Brennan is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and also CBS News senior foreign affairs correspondent as well. Thank you so much for joining us in the On Point studio today.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Lyon, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.